Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhouse. This week, a conversation with Martin Amis about his new novel, Lionel Asbo.
You wouldn't find many people hankering for the days of empire, because we don't like empires anymore. It's even quite a shame that we ever had one.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Art critic Deborah Solomon tells us about the unusual life of painter David Hockney.
He is the British Warhol, and he looms as large in England as Warhol looms here.
And Parul Sehgal has bestseller news. Martin Amis is one of the world's most accomplished and admired and prolific novelists. He's got a new book called Lionel Asbo. It's reviewed on our cover this week by Catherine Harrison, who says that Lionel Asbo is at its heart an old-fashioned novel and that Amis himself is, like Charles Dickens, an insistently moral writer. I'm delighted that Martin Amis is here to talk about his book. Welcome.
Thank you.
All right, so this new novel has a subtitle, State of England, and some of our listeners will remember that in 1996, you published a quite celebrated story in The New Yorker with exactly that title, State of England. And why does that phrase matter to you?
It's always meant something to me. There used to be a sort of genre of State of England novels a couple of generations ago. It used to be a kind of novel, State of the Nation. And England is small enough for a writer to take a reading of it. I don't think you'd ever come across an American novel called State of America, although there is Dos Passos's USA. America is too multitudinous. As Henry James said, it's more like a world than a country. But England is a country that can be perhaps, you know, evoked in a novel.
Now, we have a protagonist, Lionel Asbo, but Asbo's not really his last name. He's given himself that name.
Yeah, he didn't like his surname, which is Pepperdine. He thought it was a bloody stupid name in the first place, so he changed it to Asbo, which means antisocial behavior order.
And that's an actual thing, right? That's like a part of British law from Tony Blair's
day. Yeah, it's just about to be repealed, in fact, but it's just one more way of trying to keep tabs on the more antisocial elements or sociopathic elements.
And Lionel is a kind of exemplar of the sociopathic element in England.
That's right. And I made up I invented an imaginary southeast London borough, which encapsulates all the things that are meant by phrases like broken Britain, where the family is coming apart and the age structures are all weird and et cetera.
And talk about the age structures. There are several places in the novel, one passage that I think will become quite famous, where you describe just how collapsed generational differences are today.
And Lionel is the youngest of a family of seven, headed by a single parent who is 18 when he's born. So she's had one child a year throughout her teens. And that, of course, is not peculiar to England, that people having children younger, and in this borough, at least, dying younger, too.
And he has a nephew and ward who's also kind of a foil to him.
Yeah. It's, you know, some aspects of writing a novel are very simple and crude. And I realize that because Lionel is exceptionally bad in most senses of the word, although he retains a certain charm, that Desmond, who's the other main character, would have to be exceptionally good. Now, I don't think I've ever created a character as good as Desmond, and that brings its own kind of challenge because I'm sure my brother will say that he wished that Lionel was present on every page of the novel and no one else was in it, because those are the characters we like. It's mysterious what we like in fiction. It's not what we like in life. As Updike says, what we like is life itself. It doesn't matter what their qualities are. We like Becky Sharp. We like the villains. We like the eccentrics, not the goodies. And I'd say that perhaps only Tolstoy has made happiness really swing on the page. Happiness is null in fiction. So it was a much greater challenge to create Desmond than to create Lionel, because Desmond is good.
And there is real tension between them. I mean, there's a kind of, it's not quite a mystery, but there's a concealed drama that emerges through the telling of the narrative that pits them ever more directly against one another. There's much at stake for these two characters.
Yeah, I mean, it's Dickensian also in that I realized quite late on that it was Dickensian in genre as well as in setting, you know, inner city London. Dickens is considered a great writer without being considered a serious writer. That's because he's not a social realist. He belongs to a different kind of tradition whose main representative nowadays is the sort of Disney-ish cartoon. It's all about semi-magical twists, parent mysteries, huge rewards, and huge punishments. It is a kind of modern fairy tale.
Part of the fairy tale that you describe is this great transformation in Lionel's life when he goes from more or less impoverished miscreant to very wealthy miscreant. He wins the national lottery. And went, I think it's 140 million pounds or something, a figure very close to that. And there you do, as our listeners will remember in a classic novel like Money, you really describe the impact of this sort of absurd wealth when it's in the hands of someone like him, and what becomes of Lionel then?
Well, yeah, there's a subgroup of people called lotto louts in England. They win a certain amount of money, and then they have a lot of journalists on their trail, and they get into fights, and they're shamed in the tabloids. And I read the autobiography of one such, a guy who was not quite in prison when he got. When he won his 12 million or whatever it was.
And Lionel is in prison when he wins.
Yeah, he is in prison. And he tells his story in this quite charming autobiography. And I thought that this would be a rich field for me to see, get some ideas for what Lionel would do. When I closed the book, I realized that he couldn't follow the normal lotto lout route, which is a lot of cocaine, a country house with lots of parties and quad bikes and roller derbies and smashing up things, and that he couldn't just burn through the money in that kind of way, that it would have to be his own peculiar route, going against type, as always. So he's very mean and doesn't give any of his money away, despite having a large and impoverished group of siblings. He has to find his own route, and he gets a very supremely vulgar girlfriend who is, and his aim is to be loved by the nation, and he does eventually win that love. And then there's an explosion of atavism at the end where he returns to his violent core.
You also say at one point that he becomes a kind of symbol of the nation's blighted hopes. I mean, in some way, you know, without piling too much on poor Lionel or on a single novel, he does represent certain aspects of the English character at this moment.
Yeah, which is what? It's nostalgia for past glories, basically. More or less driven into the unconscious in most people's minds in England. You wouldn't find many people hankering for the days of empire. Because we don't like empires anymore, and we're even quite ashamed that we ever had one. People don't like demotion. It's what happens in a normal human life, the draining of powers. This creates, I think, a lot of subliminal resentment that is not acknowledged or even owned up to, or not even in people's awareness, but it's there.
I interviewed you, as you'll remember, not so long ago for another publication, and something that struck me was what seemed to be total recall for many of the phrases and sentences in this novel and earlier novels, too. And you've written a lot of books and, gosh, millions of words probably. It made me think that you work on every sentence, and you probably revise a lot. How long did it take you to write this particular novel? I ask for one other question. People, some of the reaction in Britain in particular has been that this is the novel in which you swear off or write off England. But in fact, that's not true.
That's completely not true. It shows how touchy they are back there. No, it's full of affection for England. And all writing is an expression of affection and celebration, that you can't do it from any other impulse. People have said, so you must have written this novel with complete disgust for... No, not at all. You can't write a novel with those kinds of feelings.
Do you show your work in progress to other writers, for instance, to your wife, Isabel Fonseca, also an accomplished writer, or are you a guy who works secretly?
I made an exception with this. I'm secretive, but I made an exception and showed the novel to its dedicatee, Christopher Hitchens, when it was in a shamefully crude state. And I said to him later that I wish I hadn't showed it to him, but it's dedicated to him, and I'm glad he did read it and approve it, although he approved a version that I was subsequently ashamed of. But it's okay now.
Now, Christopher Hitchens, who the late Christopher Hitchens also was a guest several times on this program, said, I believe he says this in his memoir, that he would often show drafts of work to you. You'd be very tough. You were the cliché detector and the detector of automatisms in the prose. What kind of reader was he? Did he read with that same closeness, your work?
I used to clean up Christopher's grammar, particularly his punctuation. He was weird about punctuation. He would go write a sentence like, this comes down to one thing and one thing only, semicolon, money, you know. No, colon. And also his habit of elegant variation, where he would use a different word when it's used in exactly the same application, because someone told him when he was a kid that you shouldn't use the same word twice, which is an imaginary rule, like the split infinitive. So I would be a pedant with him. With me, he was always on the lookout for laxities of thought with a political edge to it. If you were writing about the royal family, for instance, you'd have to be fierce. And I don't actually feel fierce about the royal family.
And he really did. He was a self-proclaimed Republican who thought the monarchy should be abolished.
And he said very feeble, your piece on the royal family, you know, because I didn't take that attitude. And so he was more of a commissar. I was more of a grammarian.
Thanks so much.
Pleasure.
That's Martin Amis, whose new novel, Lionel Asbo, is reviewed on the cover of this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So, notes from far afield this time, from the other side of the country, Seattle.
Yes, I had a little sojourn to Seattle the other day, and I spent some time with Maria Semple, who is the author of one of the most talked about novels of the summer, Where'd You Go, Bernadette, which was published this week by Little Brown.
Now, Maria Semple already has a fan base of sorts.
She's not well known, but she had a long career as a television writer, as a comedy writer, and she wrote for shows like Ellen, Mad About You, and most notably Arrested Development, the show that is coming back next year, but had a 3-year stint on Fox.
And why so much interest in the novel?
Well, the novel has gotten a lot of attention, partly because it is so funny. And this is a book that is Maria Semple's second novel. Her first novel got almost no attention whatsoever. It was called This One Is Mine. And it was written as a straightforward narrative. It was set in Los Angeles. And this time, Maria has written a story that in some parts mirrors her own life. She has a boyfriend and a daughter who have moved with her from Los Angeles to Seattle. Her boyfriend, who's this legendary comedy writer named George Meyer, who was one of the original writers for The Simpsons, had decided they had had enough of Los Angeles. So they picked up and moved to Seattle, a place where they didn't know a single person. And in fact, Maria told me that their realtor was the emergency contact for a while on her daughter's school forms. So she had a terrible time getting used to Seattle. And in the first few months that she was living there, she would kind of drive around in her car and making up riffs in her head about how horrible Seattle was and how there were two hairstyles, short gray hair and long gray hair. And she would complain about the five-way intersections and how everyone wore Patagonia and just complained about Seattle in her head. And that led to the character in her novel called Bernadette, who is a sort of failed architect in L.A. who moved to Seattle and hated it in many of the same ways.
Now, it's so interesting you say that about Seattle. I've been there just once, very briefly. And I mean, it's definitely one of the cities you hear about all the time in America. That's where Amazon is, and Microsoft is nearby, and Starbucks, and it has a kind of cool cachet. But I guess to Maria, it looked a little different.
It does have a cool cachet, and a lot of that is probably a little bit of a hangover from the 90s. But it is a very singular place. As a good friend of mine who grew up in Seattle and read Maria's book said, she had never read anyone be funny about Seattle before. And in a way, the city was just kind of ready to be made fun of. And it took someone who had moved there from LA and who was a veteran comedy writer to do it. And the things that she picks on are really funny, like craftsmen's. Who makes fun of craftsman houses? But in the novel, Bernadette goes on this huge rant about craftsmen's and how they're annoyingly ubiquitous. And she says, it's like a hypnotist put everyone from Seattle in a collective trance. You are getting sleepy. When you wake up, you will want to live only in a craftsman house. The year won't matter to you. All that will matter is that the walls will be thick, the windows tiny, the room's dark, the ceiling's low, and it will be poorly situated on the lot. So that's one little sample.
Anything about coffee in Seattle? Which is really good. Now, she's welcome to make fun of it, though.
The coffee's really good. You can't argue with that. And there are Starbucks on every corner. I like garbage cans in Manhattan. I mean, I was just there last week, and I was amazed at the long line of people standing to get coffee at the original Starbucks. I mean, you'd think that it would be just as good as the coffee at the Starbucks one block away, but people really want to get a cup of coffee from that original Starbucks at Pike Place Market. But she really didn't make fun of the coffee. She found so many other things to tease, like the, you know, obsession with the weather. People in Seattle really like to
talk. Well, it is gloomy and dark all the time.
They do, but, you know, as Maria/Bernadette put it, it rains all the time. Why are we always talking about the fact that it's raining? Why are we having this conversation about how, can you believe the weather? Yes, I can believe the weather. What I can't believe is that we're still talking about the weather. So this is the kind of thing that, you know, Maria kind of minds in
so
the
she's
book.
Kind of got at the slightly self-reverential piety that, say, you know, Woody Allen found in New York, or that Joan Didion gets in Southern California. She's kind of punctured that self-satisfaction in Seattle maybe a little bit.
Yes, definitely. And to be fair, that isn't all the book that it is about. I mean, there's a lot of that, and I won't give anything away by saying this, but it does take a turn. And Maria said that in her own life, she spent these first few months, she wrote the book in 3 months, the first draft, just churned it out. And she said that she couldn't have written it right now because she actually did grow to be quite fond of Seattle. And now that she's been living there for 4 years, she feels like she couldn't live anywhere else. And she really loves it. So it was sort of her entry into Seattle that produced this book. And what's interesting is that I was curious how the book was received in Seattle.
Good question.
Were people very upset about it? And it seems like people have actually been quite good-natured about it. She had her first event this week at the wonderful Elliott Bay Book Company in Seattle, and 200 people showed up, and it was a very warm reception. And I think that now she's probably been there long enough to have made some friends. Tom Skerritt, the actor, who's apparently the only celebrity in Seattle, is not connected to, you know, the tech industry, threw her a party to celebrate the book at his home and invited all these booksellers. So she's got a good reception. It seems like people in Seattle are okay with being made fun of.
So all that great coffee, all that bad weather, all those pretentious homes, but they can laugh at themselves.
Apparently so.
Thanks so much, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
David Hockney is one of the most celebrated and admired of modern painters, and unusual, he's kind of an Anglo-American figure. There's a new book, a biography, called David Hockney, The Biography, 1937 to 1975, A Rake's Progress. It's by Christopher Simon Sykes and reviewed for us by one of our favorites, the great Deborah Solomon, who is an art historian, a biographer herself, and wonderful critic. Welcome, Deborah.
Thank you, Sam. How are you?
I'm okay, thank you. Good. And what I'm wondering is why this biography of David Hockney ends in the year 1975. He didn't end in the year 1975.
No, not at all. The book is being done in two parts, which I found a bit curious, because I think if you get half a life, the problem with that is you don't get a whole life. And when you read a biography, you do want to feel the trajectory of the whole life.
And so what happened in these first 38 years at her described?
So this is mostly the young Hockney. And Hockney, of course, did have a very lively childhood. He became famous practically from the time of his birth.
I mean, now, where was he born? What's his background here?
He was born in Yorkshire, England. So he's a country boy from England, came from a very working-class family, and grew up with a father who had very eccentric politics and who actually opposed World War II and refused to fight Hitler.
Pacifist?
Right. And Hockney himself has rather eccentric politics. Lately, I don't know if you noticed this, but he just came into the news because he is a pro-smoking champion. And he criticized the Olympics because one of the actors in the opening ceremony, Kenneth Branagh, did not light up his cigar. And he thinks, how could there be fireworks but no cigar smoking at the Olympics?
So he publicly asserted this.
Right, he did, in The Guardian. He submitted some kind of text editorial.
Like an op-ed piece or something. No?
But a visual op-ed piece.
Oh, that's
a
fun.
A poster, something like that. And he's been very controversial in England because of this. I know some of his critics have called him a pro-emphysema champion, and others wonder why he doesn't champion pot smoking instead. I tell you this
yes.
because, I think you can't take everything David Hockney says at face value. There's something dopey about the pro-smoking campaign, and a lot of his utterances seem to be made really for the pleasure of amusing people. And it's important for a biographer to come in and dismantle all that. I don't know that anyone can do a good biography of a living subject.
So Hockney, at his advanced age, still has a gift for provoking people. You also said he became famous very young.
Yeah.
What brought him to public attention, and when did this happen?
He was still in art school when he started exhibiting his works, and they were basically what would later be known as pop art. The phrase was coined by the British critic Lawrence Alloway, and Hockney seems to have been born as a pop artist.
So this is when
he later refuted the label.
This is the late 1950s?
Exactly. Late 50s.
And what were those paintings like? Were they like Andy Warhol's paintings or Roy Lichtenstein's or any kind of parallel?
Well, he was very different from the American pop artist because he had no interest really in advertising or illustration on the surface.
Deborah, an artist similar in some ways to David Hockney is Andy Warhol. Describe how they compare or relate.
Hockney is certainly the Warhol of British art. They came of age at the same time, and they both began their careers as pop artists. But I think Warhol was much more interested in art as social criticism in the world of advertising, in the world of consumer goods, Campbell's soup cans, Brillo boxes, and all that. Whereas Hockney was finally interested in making art that was more autobiographical and about his own experiences as he went through the world day by day.
What made it seem pop art then? Is it the look, the techniques he used?
I would say that he always did use the techniques of pop art. If he's not technically a pop artist, he's very populist and very popular. He may be the most popular artist alive right now. And his look also comes out of pop art. Lots of flat planes that kind of have the look of graphic design. It's a very light way of looking at the world. It's almost like Matisse on a diet. Mm-hmm. If you look at his landscapes, he has the lush colors of Matisse, the beautiful blues and greens. But they're easy. Matisse is not that difficult, but Hockney is even lighter. He wants to be very accessible. Lately, he's been circulating images on his iPhone and making iPhone art, and that's admirable. He really thinks that art can connect the whole world. He's like the Beatles that way, and that's an unusual stance for a contemporary artist.
And especially one that, as you say, does insist that he's a very serious artist. And he did this unusual thing, which you described so well, is, you know, we're familiar with the artist from Great Britain who might make his pilgrimage to Florence or Venice to study the great masters. And Hockney actually did a very different thing.
Yeah, he went in the opposite direction.
He went to Venice, but a different Venice.
Right, exactly. He went to California, Southern California, which was a heresy at the time for an artist who grew up in England. And
this was when, in the 60s? He was drawn to the culture there? What brought him? Why did he go?
I'm not sure exactly. His biographer claims that he saw it as a place where he could pursue beautiful boys. And maybe he was that divided. Maybe he thought of England as a place of culture and America as a place of pleasure.
And how long did he stay in the United States?
He's been going back and forth almost his whole life.
Now, some of our listeners, I have a feeling, will be familiar with the famous swimming pool paintings.
Right, the Biggest Splash.
And tell us about those.
Okay, he isn't really known for one image in particular or even a series of images the way most artists are. And if you try to think of his best-known painting, you'll have trouble coming up with just one. But I think the swimming pool painting is probably better known than some others. It was done in 1967, so it's one of his early works. It's a very different view of California than you get in the Beach Boys songs. It's not about partying on the beach. It's set in someone's backyard, a private backyard. There's nobody there except for we see the trace of a swimmer who has left a splash in the water. It's a weirdly empty scene of Los Angeles.
That almost sounds like Joan Didion's California or something. Is it that kind of comment on
I think that's very good. I think there's more aloofness to Hockney than is commonly acknowledged, and I think he does share a lot with Didion as an observer of the California landscape.
Now, you know a great deal about the whole arc of 20th century art painting. You've said on this program that after Picasso, Warhol may be the most influential of the modern painters. Where does Hockney fit in?
He is the British Warhol, and he looms as large in England as Warhol looms here. But he's a much more wholesome figure than Warhol, which partly explains his popularity. He's always seemed approachable and almost childlike in the way he dresses and in his mismatched socks and bright shirts and striped ties. And I think he's impressive because he went off from the great movements. He didn't tie himself to any one movement. He wasn't outwardly striving for greatness. He was really sort of giving over to his curiosity and his interest in seeing and his interest in connecting people through art.
And what about his skills and techniques?
He's a fabulous draftsman.
What influence has it had on subsequent artists? Do you see signs or influences of Hockney and other people's work?
I think if you look at American figurative art right now, you see Hockney's children. If you look at an artist like Elizabeth Payton and a lot of artists who are sort of doing very casual portraiture that looks slightly dashed off and probably isn't dashed off, you find the influence of Hockney, whose art had a nice diary-like quality to it. You feel like he's just going through life and taking notes, not trying to create a big masterpiece, but just trying to capture what it feels like to go through a day in the 21st century.
Now, what has the biographer Christopher Sykes drawn on? You have written a major biography of Joseph Cornell. You have another one be coming out, a Norman Rockwell. How does Sykes go about the biographer's art of telling the story of the life of a painter?
Well, one challenge he faces is that Hockney's life already is public record. He's been famous for so long, and we all know so much about him, that I'm not sure there's a whole lot that can be revealed. So I would think the obvious tack for a biographer would be to try to shape the material. What he brings to existing material is the diary entries of Laura Hockney, David Hockney's mother. I think she emerges really as the most interesting figure in the book. She's a conservative Methodist who reads the Bible every day and who has somehow expanded her sense of modern life to make room for her son. And they're very close, and she's incredibly supportive and adoring. We see her in this book as both easily shockable, but reliably affectionate, and altogether a very moving figure.
Thanks so much, Deborah.
Thank you, Sam. Nice seeing you.
That's Deborah Solomon, who reviews David Hockney, the biography, 1937 to 1975, in this week's book review. Greg Coles is away this week, and filling in for him is his very able colleague, Parle Sagel, who's here to talk about the bestseller list. Welcome, Parle.
Hi, Sam.
All right, so what's new on the list this week? Let's start with fiction. What have we got here?
We have four new titles in fiction. We have on number four, Karen's Claw by R.A. Salvatore. It's book three of the Neverwinter Saga. At number six, we have The Spymasters by W.E.B. Griffin and William Butterworth IV. It's the seventh book in the Men at War series. At eight, we have The Untime by Sherilyn Kenyon. And at number 15, we have We Don't Want to Know by Lisa Jackson, a story about a woman whose toddler goes missing.
And nonfiction?
Nonfiction, we just have the one. We have Dearie by Bob Spitz. It's a biography of Julia Child.
Speaking of Julia Child, this is what, the 100th anniversary?
Is. Yeah, she was born August 15th, 1912.
And she is just looms increasingly as a bigger and bigger figure. Why is this?
I think there's so much material to mine. There are her years in the intelligence. There was her postings in China and Sri Lanka. There was her long love affair with, of all people, her own husband. And this is all without talking about the cooking, the food. She started cooking in her late 30s, when got her big shows in her 40s. And I think in all the areas that we're all so anxious, body, aging, achievement, she just seems to be so relaxed. Food was about pleasure. She got her start very late in life. And I think there's something cozy and comforting about her. And she never minded looking ridiculous. She loved the Dan Aykroyd. This is what Spitz talks about in his book. She loved the Dan Aykroyd impression of her on Saturday Night Live.
So she could laugh at herself.
Well, she was 6'3". You know,
was she really that tall?
She was 6'3". Her very usurious husband actually designed her a special kitchen that would accommodate her frame. And yeah, if you're 6'3", you've been turned down from the Women's Army Corps. You know, you really have to, I think, embrace who you are. I think she did. And the most improbable TV star of all.
And you know, you say improbable TV star, which she certainly was. And it reminds me, Parle, that a figure who was beloved by many in New York, Nora Ephron made maybe her best film about Julia Child. And when you described Julia Child's early career, those were some of the incidents covered in Ephron's film, Julie and Julia. I'll just ask you to speculate. What was it that Ephron saw, do you think, in Julia Child that has stayed with it? Does she add anything to the Julia Child legacy?
She made Julia Child one of those typically Nora Ephron characters. You know, warm, romantic, fallible, clumsy. So she Nora Ephronized Julia Child, I think.
And is that the image many of us have now, do you think? Meryl Streep teetering on those heels?
I think it was, from what I gather and from my own memories of growing up and watching a little bit of Julia Child, you know, it seems quite spot on, but I do think that such as like the Nora Ephron cast, that everybody becomes a Nora Ephron heroine, I think.
Thanks so much, Paul.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.